This tower of ashes. My tower is built of bricks, small, soot-gray bricks, mortared together with a shiny black substance that looks strangely like obsidian to my untrained eye, though it clearly cannot be obsidian. It sits by an arm of the skinny sea, 20 feet tall and sagging, the edge of the forest only a few feet away. I found the tower nearly 4 years ago, when Squirrel and I left Port Jameson in the silver air car that now lies gutted and overgrown in the weeds outside my doorstep. To this day I know almost nothing about the structure, but I have my theories. I do not think it was built by men, for one. It clearly predates Port Jameson, and I often suspect it predates human spaceflight. The bricks, which are curiously small, less than a quarter the size of normal bricks, are tired and weathered and old, and they crumble visibly beneath my feet. Dust is everywhere, and I know its source, for more than once I have pried loose a brick from the parapet on the roof and crushed it idly to fine dark powder in my naked fist. When the salt wind blows from the east, the tower flies a plume of ashes. Inside, the bricks are in better condition, since the wind and the rain have not touched them quite so much. But the tower is still far from pleasant. The interior is a single room full of dust and echoes, without windows. The only light comes from the circular opening in the center of the roof. A spiral stair, built of the same ancient brick as the rest, is part of the wall. Around and around it circles, like the threading on a screw, before it reaches roof level. Squirrel, who is quite small as cats go, finds the stairs easy climbing, but for human feet they are narrow and awkward. But I still climb them. Each night I return from the cool forests, my arrows black with the caked blood of the dream spiders, and my bag heavy with their poison sacks, and I set aside my bow and wash my hands, and then climb up to the roof to spend the last few hours before dawn. Across the narrow salt channel, the lights of Port Jameson burn on the island. And from up there, it is not the city I remember. The square black buildings wear a bright romantic glow at night. The lights, all smoky orange and muted blue, speak of mystery and silent song, and more than a little loneliness, while the starships rise and fall against the stars like the tireless wandering fireflies of my boyhood on old Earth. There are stories over there, I told Korbach once, before I had learned better. There are people behind every light, and each person has a life, a story. Only they lead those lives without ever touching us, so we'll never know the stories. I think I gestured then. I was, of course, quite drunk. Korbach answered with a toothy smile and a shake of his head. He was a great dark fleshy man, with a beard like knotted wire. Each month he came out from the city in his pitted black air car to drop off my supplies and take the venom I had collected, and each month we went up to the roof and got drunk together. A track driver, that was all Korbach was, a seller of cut-rate dreams and second-hand rainbows. But he fancied himself a philosopher and a student of man. "Don't fool yourself," he said to me then, his face flush with wine and darkness. "You're not missing nothing. Lives are rotten stories, you know. Real stories, now they usually got a plot to them. They start and they go on a bit, and when they end they're over. Unless the guy's got a series going. People's lives don't do that nohow. They just kind of wander around and ramble and go on and on. Nothing ever finishes." "People die," I said. "That's enough of a finish, I'd think." Korbach made a loud noise. "Sure. But have you ever known anybody to die at the right time? No, don't happen that way. Some guys fall over before their lives have properly gotten started. Some right in the middle of the best part. Others kind of linger on after everything is really over. Often, when I sit up there alone, with Squirrel warm in my lap and a glass of wine by my side, I remember Korbeck's words and the heavy way he said them, his coarse voice oddly gentle. He is not a smart man, Korbeck, but that night I think he spoke the truth, maybe never realizing it himself. But the weary realism that he offered me then is the only antidote there is for the dreams that spiders weave. But I am not Korbeck, nor can I be. And while I recognize his truth, I cannot live it. I was outside taking target practice in the late afternoon, wearing nothing but my quiver and a pair of cutoffs, when they came. It was closing on dusk, and I was loosening up for my nightly foray into the forest. Even in those early days, I lived from twilight to dawn, as the dream spiders do. The grass felt good under my bare feet. The double-curved silverwood bow felt even better in my hand, and I was shooting well. Then I heard them coming. I glanced over my shoulder toward the beach and saw the dark blue air car swelling rapidly against the eastern sky. Jerry, of course. I knew that from the sound. His air car had been making noises as long as I had known him. I turned my back on them, drew another arrow quite steady, and notched my first bullseye of the day. Jerry set his air car down in the weeds near the base of the tower, just a few feet from my own. Crystal was with him, slim and grave, her long gold hair full of red glints from the afternoon sun. They climbed out and started toward me. "Don't stand near the target," I told them, as I slipped another arrow into place and bent the bow. "How did you find me?" The twang of the arrow vibrating in the target punctuated my question. They circled well around my line of fire.
"You'd mentioned spotting this place from the air once," Jerry said, "and we knew you weren't anywhere in Port Jameson. Figured it was worth a chance."
He stopped a few feet from me, with his hands on his hips, looking just as I remembered him. Big, dark-haired, and very fit. Crystal came up beside him and put one hand lightly on his arm. I lowered my bow and turned to face them.
"So? Well, you found me. Why?"
"I was worried about you, Johnny," Crystal said softly, but she avoided my eyes when I looked at her. Jerry put a hand around her waist, very possessively, and something flared within me.
"Running away never solves anything," he told me,
his voice full of the strange mixture of friendly concern and patronizing arrogance he had been using on me for months.
"I did not run away," I said, my voice strained. "Damn it! You should never have come."
Crystal glanced at Jerry, looking very sad, and it was clear that suddenly she was thinking the same thing. Jerry just frowned. I don't think he ever once understood why I said the things I said or did the things I did. Whenever we discussed the subject, which was infrequently, he would only tell me with vague puzzlement what he would have done if our roles had been reversed. It seemed infinitely strange to him that anyone could possibly do anything differently in the same position. His frown did not touch me, but he'd already done his damage. For the month I'd been in my self-imposed exile at the tower, I had been trying to come to terms with my actions and my moods, and it had been far from easy. Crystal and I had been together for a long time, nearly 4 years, when we came to Jameson's world, trying to track down some unique silver and obsidian artifacts that we'd picked up on Baldur. I had loved her all that time, and I still loved her, even now, after she had left me for Jerry.
When I was feeling good about myself, it seemed to me that the impulse that had driven me out of Port Jameson was a noble and unselfish one. I wanted Chris to be happy, simply, and she could not be happy with me there. My wounds were too deep, and I wasn't good at hiding them. My presence put the damper of guilt on the newborn joy she'd found with Jerry. And since she could not bear to cut me off completely, I felt compelled to cut myself off. For them. For her. Or so I liked to tell myself. But there were hours when that bright rationalization broke down. Dark hours of self-loathing. Were those the real reasons? Or was I simply out to hurt myself in a fit of angry immaturity, and by doing so punish them, like a willful child who plays with thoughts of suicide as a form of revenge? I honestly didn't know. For a month, I'd fluctuated from one belief to the other while I tried to understand myself and decide what I'd do next. I wanted to think myself a hero, willing to make a sacrifice for the happiness of the woman I loved. But Jerry's words made it clear that he didn't see it that way at all. "Why do you have to be so damned dramatic about everything?" he said, looking stubborn. He had been determined all along to be very civilized, and seemed perpetually annoyed at me because I wouldn't shape up and heal my wounds so that everybody could be friends. Nothing annoyed me quite so much as his annoyance. I thought I was handling the situation pretty well, all things considered, and I resented the inference that I wasn't. But Jerry was determined to convert me, and my best withering look was wasted on him. "We're going to stay here and talk things out until you agree to fly back to Port Jameson with us," he told me, in his most forceful, now-I'm-getting-tough tone. "Like shit," I said, turning sharply away from them and yanking an arrow from my quiver. I slid it into place, pulled and released, all too quickly. The arrow missed the target by a good foot and buried itself in the soft, dark brick of my crumbling tower. "What is this place, anyway?" Chris asked, looking at the tower as if she'd just seen it for the first time. It's possible that she had. That it took the incongruous sight of my arrow lodging in stone to make her notice the ancient structure. More likely, though, it was a premeditated change of subject, designed to cool the argument that was building between Jerry and me. I lowered my bow again and walked up to the target to recover the arrows I'd expended. "I'm really not sure," I said, somewhat mollified and anxious to pick up the cue she'd thrown me. "A watchtower, I think, of non-human origin. Jameson's world has never been thoroughly explored. It may have had a sentient race once." I walked around the target to the tower and yanked loose the final arrow from the crumbling brick. "It still may, actually. We know very little of what goes on the mainland."
"A damn gloomy place to live, if you ask me," Jerry put in, looking over the tower. "Could fall in any moment from the way it looks."
I gave him a bemused smile. The thought had occurred to me. But when I first came out here, I was past caring. As soon as the words were out, I regretted saying them. Chris winced visibly. That had been the whole story of my final weeks in Port Jameson. Try as I might, it had seemed that I had only two choices. I could lie, or I could hurt her. Neither appealed to me, so here I was. But here they were, too. So the whole impossible situation was back. Jerry had another comment ready, but he never got to say it. Just then Squirrel came bounding out from between the weeds, straight at Crystal. She smiled at him and knelt, and an instant later he was at her feet licking her hand and chewing on her fingers. Squirrel was in a good mood, clearly. He liked life near the tower. Back in Port Jameson, his life had been constrained by Crystal's fears that he'd be eaten by alley snarls, or chased by dogs, or strung up by local children. Out here, I let him run free, which was much more to his liking. The brush around the tower was overrun by whipping mice, a native rodent with a hairless tail 3 times its own body length. The tail packed a mild sting, but Squirrel didn't care, even though he swelled up and got grouchy every time a tail connected. He liked stalking whipping mice all day. Squirrel always fancied himself a great hunter, and there's no skill involved in chasing down a bowl of cat food. He'd been with me even longer than Chris had, but she'd become suitably fond of him during our time together. I often suspected that Crystal would have gone with Jerry even sooner than she did, except that she was upset at the idea of leaving Squirrel. Not that he was any great beauty. He was a small, thin, scuffy-looking cat, with ears like a fox and fur a scroungy gray-brown color, and a big bushy tail 2 sizes too big for him. The friend who gave him to me back on Avalon informed me gravely that Squirrel was the illegitimate offspring of a genetically engineered psycat and a mangy alley tom. But if Squirrel could read his owner's mind, he didn't pay much attention. When he wanted affection, he'd do things like climb right up on the book I was reading and knock it away and begin biting my chin. When he wanted to be let alone, it was dangerous folly to try to pet him. As Crystal knelt by him and stroked him, and Squirrel nuzzled up to her hand, she seemed very much the woman I'd traveled with and loved and talked to at endless length and slept with every night. And I suddenly realized how I'd missed her. I think I smiled. The sight of her, even under these conditions, still gave me a cloud-shadowed joy. Maybe I was being silly and stupid and vindictive to send them away, I thought, after they had come so far to see me. Chris was still Chris, and Jerry could hardly be so bad, since she loved him. Watching her, wordless, I made a sudden decision. I would let them stay, and we could see what happened. "It's close to dusk," I heard myself saying. "Are you folks hungry?" Chris looked up, still petting Squirrel, and smiled. Jerry nodded.
"Sure."
"All right," I said. I walked past them, turned and paused in the doorway, and gestured them inside. "Welcome to my ruin." I turned on the electric torches and set about making dinner. My lockers were well stocked back in those days. I had not yet started living off the forests. I thawed 3 big sand dragons, the silver-shelled crustacean that Jamie Fisherman dragged for relentlessly, and served them up with bread and cheese and white wine. Mealtime conversation was polite and guarded. We talked of mutual friends in Port Jameson. Crystal told me about a letter she'd received from a couple we had known on Baldur. Jerry held forth on politics and the efforts of the port police to crack down on the traffic in dreaming venom.
"The council is sponsoring research on some sort of super pesticide that would wipe out the dream spiders," he told me. "A saturation spraying of the near coast would cut off most of the supply, I'd think."
"Certainly," I said, a bit high on the wine and a bit piqued at Jerry's stupidity. Once again, listening to him, I had found myself questioning Crystal's taste. "Never mind what other effects it might have on the ecology, right?" Jerry shrugged. "Mainland," he said simply. He was Jamie through and through, and the comment translated to, "Who cares?" The accidents of history had given the residents of Jameson's world a singularly cavalier attitude toward their planet's one large continent. Most of the original settlers had come from Old Poseidon, where the sea had been a way of life for generations. The rich, teeming oceans and peaceful archipelagos of their new world had attracted them far more than the dark forests of the mainland. Their children grew up to the same attitudes, except for a handful who found an illegal profit selling dreams.
"Don't shrug it all off so easy," I said.
"Be realistic," he replied.
The mainland's no use to anyone, except the Spider-Men. Who would it hurt?
Damn it, Jerry, look at this tower. Where did it come from? Tell me that. I tell you, there might be intelligence out there in those forests. The Jamies have never even bothered to look.
Crystal was nodding over her wine.
Johnny could be right, she said, glancing at Jerry. That's why I came here, remember? The artifacts. The shop on Baldur said they were shipped out of Port Jameson. He couldn't trace them back any farther than that. And the workmanship. I've handled alien art for years, Jerry. I know Findi work, and Damouche, and I've seen all the others. This was different.
Jerry only smiled. Proves nothing. There are other races, millions of them, farther in toward the core. The distances are too great, so we don't hear of them very often, except maybe third hand. But it isn't impossible that every so often a piece of their art would trickle through. He shook his head. No, I'd bet this tower was put up by some early settler. Who knows? Could be there was another discoverer before Jameson who never reported his find. Maybe he built the place. But I'm not going to buy mainland sentience. At least not until you fumigate the damned forests and they all come out waving their spears, I said sourly. Jerry laughed, and Crystal smiled at me. And suddenly I had an overpowering desire to win this argument. My thoughts had the hazy clarity that only wine can give, and it seemed so logical. I was so clearly right, and here was my chance to show up Jerry like the provincial he was and make points with Chris. I leaned forward. If you Jamies would ever look, you might find sentience, I said. I've only been on the mainland a month, and already I've found a great deal. You've no damned concept of the kind of beauty you talk so blithely of wiping out. A whole ecology is out there, different from the islands. Species upon species. A lot probably not even discovered yet. But what do you know about it? Any of you?
Jerry nodded.
So show me. He stood up suddenly. I'm always willing to learn, Bowen. Why don't you take us out and show us all the wonders of the mainland?
I think Jerry was trying to make points, too. He probably never thought I'd take up his offer, but it was exactly what I'd wanted. It was dark outside now, and we had been talking by the light of my torches. Above, stars shone through the hole in my roof. The forest would be alive now, eerie and beautiful, and I was suddenly eager to be out there, bow in hand, in a world where I was a force and a friend, Jerry a bumbling tourist.
Crystal? I said.
She looked interested.
Sounds like fun, if it's safe.
It will be, I said. I'll take my bow.
We both rose, and Chris looked happy. I remembered the times we tackled Baldurian wilderness together, and suddenly I felt very happy, certain that everything would work out well. Jerry was just part of a bad dream. She couldn't possibly be in love with him. First, I found the sober-ups. I was feeling good, but not good enough to head out into the forest when I was still dizzy from wine. Crystal and I flipped ours down immediately, and seconds after, my alcoholic glow began to fade. Jerry, however, waved away the pill I offered him.
I haven't had that much, he insisted. Don't need it.
I shrugged, thinking that things were getting better and better. If Jerry went crashing drunkenly through the woods, it couldn't help but turn Chris away from him.
Suit yourself, I said.
Neither of them was really dressed for wilderness, but I hoped that wouldn't be a problem, since I didn't really plan on taking them very deep in the forest. It would be a quick trip, I thought. Wander down my trail a bit, show them the dust pile and the spider chasm, maybe nail a dream spider for them. Nothing to it. Out and back again. I put on a dark coverall, heavy trail boots, and my quiver, handed Crystal a flash in case we wandered away from the Blue Moss regions, and picked up my bow.
"You really need that?"
Jerry asked with sarcasm.
"Protection," I said.
"Can't be that dangerous."
"It isn't, if you know what you're doing." But I didn't tell him that.
"Then why do you Jamies stay on your islands?"
He smiled.
"I'd rather trust a laser."
"I'm cultivating a death wish.
A bow gives the prey a chance of sorts." Chris gave me a smile of shared memories.
"He only hunts predators,"
she told Jerry. I bowed.
Squirrel agreed to guard my castle.
Steady and very sure of myself, I belted on a knife and led my ex-wife and her lover out into the forests of Jameson's world. We walked in single file, close together, me up front with the bow, Chris following, Jerry behind her. Chris used the flashlight when we first set out, playing it over the trail as we wound our way through the thick grove of spike arrows that stood like a wall against the sea. Tall and very straight, crusty gray of bark, and some as big around as my tower, they climbed to a ridiculous height before sprouting their meager load of branches. Here and there they crowded together and squeezed the path between them, and more than one seemingly impassable fence of wood confronted us suddenly in the dark. But Chris could always pick out the way, with me a foot ahead of her to point her flash when it paused. 10 minutes out from the tower, the character of the forest began to change. The ground and the very air were drier here, the wind cool, but without the snap of salt. The water-hungry spike arrows had drained most of the moisture from the air. They began to grow smaller and less frequent, the spaces between them larger and easier to find. Other species of plant began to appear. Stunted little goblin trees, sprawling mock oaks, graceful ebon fires, whose red veins pulsed brilliantly in the dark wood when caught by Crystal's wandering flash. And blue moss. Just a little at first. Here a ropey web dangling from a goblin's arm, there a small patch on the ground, frequently chewing its way up the back of an ebon fire or a withering solitary spike arrow. Then more and more, thick carpets underfoot, mossy blankets on the leaves above, heavy trailers that dangled from the branches and danced around in the wind. Crystal sent the flash darting about, finding bigger and better bunches of the soft blue fungus, and peripherally, I began to see the glow. "Enough," I said, and Chris turned off the light. Darkness lasted only for a moment, till our eyes adjusted to a dimmer light. Around us, the forest was suffused by a gentle radiance, as the blue moss drenched us in its ghostly phosphorescence. We were standing near one side of a small clearing, below a shiny black ebon fire, but even the flames of its red-veined wood seemed cool in the faint blue light. The moss had taken over the undergrowth, supplanting all the local grasses and making nearby shrubs into fuzzy blue beach balls. It climbed the sides of most of the trees, and when we looked up through the branches at the stars, we saw that other colonies had set upon the woods a glowing crown. I laid my bow carefully against the dark flank of the ebon fire, bent, and offered a handful of light to Crystal. When I held it under her chin, she smiled at me again, her features softened by the cool magic in my hand. I remember feeling very good to have led them to this beauty. But Jerry only grinned at me.
"Is this what we're going to endanger, Bowen?" he asked. "A forest full of blue moss?"
I dropped the moss.
"You don't think it's pretty?"
Jerry shrugged.
"Sure it's pretty. It is also a fungus, a parasite with a dangerous tendency to overrun and crowd out all other forms of plant life. Blue moss was very thick on Jolastar and the Barbus Archipelago once, you know. We rooted it all out. It can eat its way through a good corn crop in a month."
He shook his head, and Crystal nodded.
"He's right,
you know,
she said. I looked at her for a long time, suddenly feeling very sober indeed, the last memory of the wine long gone. Abruptly it dawned on me that I had, all unthinking, built myself another fantasy. Out here, in a world I had started to make my own, a world of dream spiders and magic moss, somehow I had thought that I could recapture my own dream long fled, my smiling crystalline soulmate. In the timeless wilderness of the mainland, she would see us both in fresh light and would realize once again that it was me she loved. So I'd spun a pretty web, bright and alluring as the trap of any dream spider, and Chris had shattered the flimsy filaments with a word. She was his, mine no longer, not now, not ever. And if Jerry seemed to me stupid or insensitive or overpractical, well, perhaps it was those very qualities that made Chris choose him. And perhaps not. I had no right to second-guess her love, and possibly I would never understand it. I brushed the last flakes of glowing moss from my hands while Jerry took the heavy flash from Crystal and flicked it on again. My blue fairyland dissolved, burned away by the bright white reality of his flashlight beam. "What now?" he asked, smiling. He was not so very drunk after all. I lifted my bow from where I'd set it down. "Follow me," I said quickly, curtly. Both of them looked eager and interested, but my own mood had shifted dramatically. Suddenly the whole trip seemed pointless. I wished that they were gone, that I was back at my tower with Squirrel. I was down and sinking. Deeper in the moss-heavy woods, we came upon a dark, swift stream, and the brilliance of the flashlight speared a solitary iron horn that had come to drink. It looked up quickly, pale and startled, then bounded away through the trees, for a fleeting instant looking a bit like the unicorn of old Earth legend. Long habit made me glance at Crystal, but her eyes sought Jerry's when she laughed. Later, as we climbed a rocky incline, a cave loomed near at hand. From the smell, a wood snarl lair. I turned to warn them around it, only to discover that I'd lost my audience. They were 10 steps behind me at the bottom of the rocks, walking very slowly and talking quietly, holding hands. Dark and angry, wordless, I turned away again and continued on over the hill. We did not speak again until I'd found the dust pile. I paused on its edge, my boots an inch deep in the fine gray powder, and they came straggling up behind me. "Go ahead, Jerry," I said. "Use your flash here." The light roamed. The hill was at our back, rocky and lit here and there with the blurred cold fire of blue moss-choked vegetation. But in front of us was only desolation, a wide, vacant plain, black and blasted and lifeless, open to the stars. Back and forth Jerry moved the flashlight, pushing at the borders of the dust nearby, fading as he shone it straight out into the gray distance. The only sound was the wind. "So?" he said at last. "Feel the dust," I told him. I was not going to stoop this time. "And when you're back at the tower, crush one of my bricks and feel that. It's the same thing, a sort of powdery ash." I made an expansive gesture. "I'd guess there was a city here once, but now it's all crumbled into dust. Maybe my tower was an outpost of the people who built it. You see?"
"The vanished sentience of the forest," Jerry said, still smiling. "Well, I'll admit there's nothing like this on the islands. For a good reason. We don't let forest fires rage unchecked."
"Forest fire?
Don't give me that. Forest fires don't reduce everything to a fine powder. You always get a few blackened stumps or something.
Oh? You're probably right. But all the ruined cities I know have at least a few bricks still piled on top of one another for the tourists to take pictures of, Jerry said.
The flash beam flicked to and fro over the dust pile, dismissing it.
All you have is a mound of rubbish.
Crystal said nothing. I began walking back, while they followed in silence. I was losing points every minute. It had been idiocy to bring them out here. At that moment, nothing more was on my mind than getting back to my tower as quickly as possible, packing them off to Port Jameson together, and resuming my exile. Crystal stopped me, after we'd come back over the hill into the Blue Moss Forest.
Johnny, she said.
I stopped. They caught up. Chris pointed. Turn off the light, I told Jerry. In the fainter illumination of the moss, it was easier to spot. The intricate iridescent web of a dream spider, slanting groundward from the low branches of a mock oak. The patches of moss that shone softly all around us were nothing to this. Each web strand was as thick as my little finger, oily and brilliant, running with the colors of the rainbow. Chris took a step toward it, but I took her by the arm and stopped her. The spiders are around someplace, I said. Don't go too close. Papa Spider never leaves the web, and Mama ranges around in the trees at night. Jerry glanced upward a little apprehensively. His flash was dark, and suddenly he didn't seem to have all the answers. The dream spiders are dangerous predators, and I suppose he'd never seen one outside of a display case. They weren't native to the islands.
Pretty big web, he said. Spiders must be a fair size.
Fair, I said, and at once I was inspired. I could discomfort him a lot more if an ordinary web like this got to him, and he had been discomforting me all night. Follow me. I'll show you a real dream spider. We circled around the web carefully, never seeing either of its guardians. I led them to the spider chasm. It was a great V in the sandy earth, once a creek bed, perhaps, but dry and overgrown now. The chasm is hardly very deep by daylight, but at night it looks formidable enough as you stare down into it from the wooded hills on either side. The bottom is a dark tangle of shrubbery, alive with little flickering phantom lights. Higher up, trees of all kinds lean into the chasm, almost meeting in the center. One of them, in fact, does cross the gap. An ancient, rotting spike arrow, withered by lack of moisture, had fallen long ago to provide a natural bridge. The bridge hangs with blue moss and glows. The three of us walked out on that dim-lit curving trunk, and I gestured down. Yards below us, a glittering multi-hued net hung from hill to hill, each strand of the web thick as a cable and a glisten with sticky oils. It tied all the lower trees together in a twisting, intricate embrace, and it was a shining fairy roof above the chasm. Very pretty. It made you want to reach out and touch it. That, of course, was why the dream spiders spun it. They were nocturnal predators, and the bright colors of their webs afire in the night made a potent lure.
Look, Crystal said. The spider.
She pointed. In one of the darker corners of the web, half hidden by the tangle of a goblin tree that grew out of the rock, it was sitting. I could see it dimly, by the web fire and moss light, a great eight-legged white thing the size of a large pumpkin, unmoving, waiting. Jerry glanced around uneasily again,
up into the branches of a crooked mock oak that hung partially above us.
"The mate's around somewhere, isn't it?"
I nodded. The dream spiders of Jameson's world are not quite twins to the arachnids of old Earth. The female is indeed the deadlier of the species, but far from eating the male, she takes him for life in a permanent specialized partnership. For it is the sluggish, great-bodied male who wears the spinnerets, who weaves the shining fire web and makes it sticky with his oils, who binds and ties the prey snared by light and color. Meanwhile, the smaller female roams the dark branches, her poison sac full of the viscous dreaming venom that grants bright visions and ecstasy and final blackness. Creatures many times her own size, she stings and drags limp back to the web to add to the larder. The dream spiders are soft, merciful hunters for all that. If they prefer live food, no matter. The captive probably enjoys being eaten. Popular Jamie Wisdom says a spider's prey moans with joy as it is consumed. Like all popular wisdoms, it is vastly exaggerated. But the truth is, the captives never struggle. Except that night, something was struggling in the web below us. "What's that?" I said, blinking. The iridescent web was not even close to empty. The half-eaten corpse of an ironhorn lay close at hand below us, and some great dark bat was bound in bright strands just slightly farther away. But these were not what I watched. In the corner opposite the male spider, near the western trees, something was caught and fluttering. I remember a brief glimpse of thrashing pale limbs, wide, luminous eyes, and something like wings. But I did not see it clearly. That was when Jerry slipped. Maybe it was the wine that made him unsteady, or maybe the moss under our feet, or the curve of the trunk on which we stood. Maybe he was just trying to step around me to see whatever it was I was staring at. But in any case, he slipped and lost his balance, let out a yelp, and suddenly he was 5 yards below us, caught in the web. The whole thing shook to the impact of his fall, but it didn't come close to breaking. Dream spider webs are strong enough to catch ironhorns and wood snarls, after all.
"Damn!" Jerry yelled.
He looked ridiculous. One leg plunged right down through the fibers of the web, his arms half sunk and tangled hopelessly, only his head and shoulders really free of the mess.
"This stuff is sticky. I can hardly move."
"Don't try," I told him. "It'll just get worse. I'll figure out a way to climb down and cut you loose. I've got my knife." I looked around, searching for a tree limb to shimmy out on.
"John." Crystal's voice was tense, on edge.
The male spider had left his lurking place behind the goblin tree. He was moving toward Jerry with a heavy, deliberate gait, a gross white shape clamoring over the preternatural beauty of his web. "Damn," I said. I wasn't seriously alarmed, but it was a bother. The great male was the biggest spider I'd ever seen, and it seemed a shame to kill him. But I didn't see that I had much choice. The male dream spider has no venom, but he is a carnivore, and his bite can be most final, especially when he's the size of this one. I couldn't let him get within biting distance of Jerry. Steadily, carefully, I drew a long gray arrow out of my quiver and fitted it to my bowstring. It was night, of course, but I wasn't really worried. I was a good shot, and my target was outlined clearly by the glowing strands of his web. Crystal screamed. I stopped briefly, annoyed that she'd panic when everything was under control. But I knew all along that she would not, of course. It was something else. For an instant, I couldn't imagine what it could be. Then I saw, as I followed Chris's eyes with my own. A fat white spider, the size of a big man's fist, had dropped down from the mock oak to the bridge we were standing on, not 10 feet away. Crystal, thank God, was safe behind me. I stood there. How long? I don't know. If I had just acted without stopping, without thought, I could have handled everything. I should have taken care of the male first, with the arrow I had ready. There would have been plenty of time to pull a second arrow for the female. But I froze, instead, caught in that dark, bright moment, for an instant timeless, my bow in my hand yet unable to act. It was all so complicated suddenly. The female was scuttling toward me, faster than I would have believed, and it seemed so much quicker and deadlier than the slow white thing below. Perhaps I should take it out first. I might miss, and then I would need time to go for my knife or a second arrow. Except that would leave Jerry tangled and helpless under the jaws of the male that moved toward him inexorably. He could die. He could die. Crystal could never blame me. I had to save myself and her. She would understand that. And I'd have her back again. Yes. No! Crystal was screaming, screaming. And suddenly everything was clear, and I knew what it had all meant, and why I was here in this forest, and what I had to do. There was a moment of glorious transcendence. I had lost the gift of making her happy, my Crystal. But now, for a moment suspended in time, that power had returned to me, and I could give or withhold happiness forever. With an arrow, I could prove a love that Jerry would never match. I think I smiled. I'm sure I did. And my arrow flew darkly through the cool night and found its mark in the bloated white spider that raced across a web of light. The female was on me, and I made no move to kick it away or crush it beneath my heel. There was a sharp, stabbing pain in my ankle. Bright and many-colored are the webs the dream spiders weave. At night, when I return from the forests, I clean my arrows carefully and open my great knife with its slim barbed blade to cut apart the poison sacks I've collected. I slit them open each in turn, as I have earlier cut them from the still white bodies of the dream spiders, and then I drain the venom off into a bottle to wait for the day when Korbeck flies out to collect it. Afterwards, I set out the miniature goblet, exquisitely wrought in silver and obsidian and bright with spider motifs, and pour it full of the heavy black wine they bring me from the city. I stir the cup with my knife, around and around, until the blade is shiny clean again, and the wine a trifle darker than before, and I ascend to the roof. Often Korbeck's words will return to me then, and with them my story. Crystal, my love, and Jerry, and a night of lights and spiders. It all seemed so very right for that brief moment, when I stood upon the moss-covered bridge with an arrow in my hand and decided. And it has all gone so very, very wrong. From the moment I awoke, after a month of fever and visions, to find myself in the tower where Chris and Jerry had taken me to nurse me back to health. My decision, my transcendent choice, was not so final as I would have thought. At times I wonder if it was a choice. We talked about it, often, while I regained my strength, and the tale that Crystal tells me is not the one that I remember. She says that we never saw the female at all, until it was too late, that it dropped silently onto my neck just as I released the arrow that killed the male. Then, she says, she smashed it with the flashlight that Jerry had given her to hold, and I went tumbling into the web. In fact, there is a wound on my neck, and none on my ankle. And her story has a ring of truth.
for I have come to know the dream spiders in the slow-flowing years since that night, and I know that the females are stealthy killers that drop down on their prey unawares. They do not charge across fallen trees like berserk ironhorns. It is not the spider's way. And neither Crystal nor Jerry has any memory of a pale winged thing flapping in the web. Yet I remember it clearly, as I remember the female spider that scuttled toward me during the endless years that I stood frozen. But then, they say the bite of a dream spider does strange things to your mind. That could be it, of course. Sometimes, when Squirrel comes behind me up the stairs, scraping the sooty bricks with his 8 white legs, the wrongness of it all hits me, and I know I've dwelt with dreams too long. Yet the dreams are often better than the waking. The stories so much finer than the lives. Crystal did not come back to me, then or ever. They left when I was healthy, and the happiness I'd brought her with the choice that was not a choice, and the sacrifice not a sacrifice, my gift to her forever, it lasted less than a year. Corbeck tells me that she and Jerry broke up violently, and that she has since left Jameson's world. I suppose that's truth enough, if you can believe a man like Corbeck. I don't worry about it overmuch. I just kill dream spiders, drink wine, pet squirrel, and each night I climb this tower of ashes to gaze at distant lights.